Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Guys, welcome to the Everyday Warrior Podcast. I've been waiting for this one in anticipation for a man I highly admire and who you know. And if you don't know him by name, you'll know him by his reputation and what he's built. So this individual, one, what I most highly respect, and I respect the fact that he's built, I'll say it, an empire. Billionaire, with a B by his name. He was a United States Marine, a Vietnam veteran, Purple Heart recipient, Combat Action Ribbon, and the Vietnamese Cross for Gallantry. And if you talk about a role model for enlisted Marines, even officers, because officers get out of the Marine Corps, they can't replicate what he's done. He took what he learned from the Marine Corps and created, one, a multi-million dollar company, sold it, didn't stop there, and created GoDaddy, which we all know. If you own a website, it's usually through GoDaddy. Bob, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it is my absolute pleasure, Mike.
It's I think I have more of a fascination with business leaders than I do military leaders. Maybe that's because we served in it and we sometimes know the ground truth. And we probably both served for some great leaders in the Marine Corps. There were still a few Vietnam guys when I came in 98.
Yeah.
Different. Cut from a different cloth.
Well, you know, it's, I don't know if it cut from a different cloth, but it sure seems like it was just yesterday. Mm. And I mean, you know, I look at it now, I look in the mirror, I'm 73. And, you know, I'd be ready to serve again if I had the opportunity.
And I want to dig into that. But first, what I love is this is the American story. Because you weren't born with a silver spoon in your mouth. Actually, the opposite side of the spectrum.
Yeah,
I would say dirt poor.
You know, less than that, actually. I always say I was born with a broken, dirty plastic one. And both my parents, I grew up in East Baltimore. Both my parents were compulsive gamblers and loved them to death. But, you know, a gambler by just definition, they're broke all the time. And so anything they bought was on credit. And I mean, so we had people hounding us for money and this and that and the other thing. And so if I had to wanted anything, I had to figure it out myself. And that's the genesis of how I got going. You know, one little just anecdote is I never had anybody to teach me how to tie my shoes. So I figured it out by myself. And I eventually got to the point where I could make two bows and they'd come undone when I pulled the string. Now, my way of doing it is like anybody else's in the world, unlike it. But it works and it's fast and that's how I tie them today.
Would you say you still have gambler in your blood? Because, I mean, entrepreneurs, which you've taken it from startup to billion-dollar sales, there is a bit of, maybe it's more calculated risk.
I think so. I don't consider myself a gambler because most of the stuff that I do, I have a reasonable, you know, I have a more than a reasonable expectation that it's going to work. And, you know, I have a tendency to be optimistic about these sort of things. I'll have people tell me sometimes when I'd start something, they'd say, well, what if it doesn't work? And I always would say, yeah, but what if it does?
Would you say you're high in drive? Maybe too high?
No, I don't know about too high, but I'm definitely high in drive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I didn't graduate with my high school class. And it wasn't from a lack of aptitude or competency. I just had no focus. I mean, in your new book, and I can't wait, we'll release this the day, May 7th, it comes out, Fire in the Hole, which first off is a is a great title.
Thank you.
Surprised it wasn't taken. But you said in the book that I just wasn't the best student at the time.
Well, that's an understatement. That makes me sound like I was ready for the dean's list. I was terrible. I mean, I was beyond terrible. I failed the fifth grade, and through a fluke, I didn't have to repeat it. So I went into the sixth grade with about third grade skills. And then every year for me, whether I passed or failed, was a photo finish. And I mean, you could just see the nose right at the end of the line, barely touching the pass wire. But when I was in high school, I was ready not to graduate because I was failing most subjects. Mm-hmm. This was in 1968. The Vietnam War was raging. I had two buddies come up to me and said, "Hey, Bob, we're going to go talk to the Marine Corps recruiter after school. You want to go with us?" I said, "Sure." Well, we all joined. So I took my orders when I eventually got them and showed them to all my teachers. They all passed me. So I owed a Marine Corps my high school diploma.
I should have used that tactic. Maybe I would have graduated with my class. You know, you talk about it in your book, you went to a parochial school. I went to a Catholic school, high school. It was almost corporal punishment.
Well, back then. Oh, they were big time. Big corporal punishment, big time. I mean, they were something. You know, the nuns were, I had for my third grade teacher, her name was Sister Lewis Gonzaga. You know, she, when I was in there, she, would ask his kids, you know, because she, you know, she told us that the Blessed Mother appeared to her and gave her a note saying that the world was going to end in 1960. And I know, and it just was right around then. So she asked this kid once, "Well, what do you want to be when you grow up?" He goes, I might have said, "I want to be an attorney." And she says, "Well, you might as well forget that because you and your parents are both going to fry in hell."
God bless the Catholics. They used to use, I know my old man said they used to use the ruler.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I got that many a time.
Was it ruler on the hands?
Well, if it was a thin one, it'd be on the knuckles. If it was a thick one, it'd be on the palm of your hand, which did it. And they would never do it to seriously hurt you, but they would do it enough so you'd, wow. Now, in the seventh grade, when I was in the seventh grade, remember I told you I was terrible at school. The nun used to put me under her desk. Yeah, I kid you not. So, you know, it's a desk, had a vanity shield. Yes. And she was down there, and she was like an older nun, Sister Vincentia. And so she put me down there, and I'd be just sitting down there playing with dust bunnies. And every once in a while, she thought I was moving too much, she'd kick me. And so I went and told my father, and my brother had something happen to him in his class. Mm-hmm. And my father took us out and put us to public school. Happy day for us.
No kidding.
But what happened was that nun, the day we left, she took a fall down a flight of steps and killed herself by, I'm sure, yes, total accident.
Yes.
Right? Well, the deal was, and you know, you got to look at this through the eyes of a seventh grader that's changing schools, right? The whole school got a week off to mourn her death. And I didn't get any time off. I went right to school.
That's how a young man would think. Yes.
And I thought, son of a bitch. And then I thought, well, you know what? At least I'm not going to, you know, I won't have to worry about seeing her again. Then it occurred to me, well, she always told me I was going to hell. And I see no reason she wouldn't be there. Boo.
So you actually, you're part of the probably, what, 10% or 20% that actually volunteered. You, when you enlisted, you had to know you were going to Vietnam.
Yeah, I had a pretty good idea.
What was boot camp like? Because I know it was much different than when I went through in 98.
Well, boot camp was 8 weeks. And, you know, it was 16 weeks way before, you know, we started. And then it whittled down to 8 to get troops over
the
there.
Machine.
Yeah. And it was, I mean, the language, I'm sure, was very different than it was today, especially as far as, you know, some of the songs you'd sing, like, you know, I don't know, but I've been told.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
And it was tough. I used to work in a filling station before I went into the Marine Corps, and I had a pencil, and I would always keep a pencil in, you know, in the back of my ear, so I'd have it handy. And so it just became a habit. I'd do that with a pencil. Well, damn DI, come out of one of the classes, and, you know, the Marine Corps pretty regimented. You don't want to walk around with a pencil in your ear. So he sees me with this, and he comes beelining over, grabs me and goes, "What the fuck are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I just, you know, with the pencil," I said, "I worked at a film station, this, that." And he says, "I'm going to give you the break of your life. You're not going to have to, I don't want to see that pencil there again. If I see it, I'm going to shove it up your ass." The next day, he catches me with the pencil behind my ear, takes me, pushes me against a building, and keeps pushing this thing into the small of my throat. And I thought I was going to get a tracheotomy. I mean, you know, it bled a little bit, and goddamn. So, you know, he says, "Next time, I'm going to kill you." and I believed him. So the next day, I'm coming out. I got that fucking pencil behind my ear. And I reached up, and I caught it before he seen it. And I never put it up there again.
You know, I think for most people, Full Metal Jacket is probably the appearance they have of boot camp. But I just, the Marine Corps does a very good job of training those DIs. And as a candidate, recruit, they put the fear of God in you.
Yeah.
They are good at that.
Oh, 100%. And, you know, the one thing I'll tell you is everything I've ever accomplished in my life, I owe to the Marine Corps. 100%. The stuff I did when I got out of school, and since in business, I'd have never done any of that without what they taught me. And as far as I'm concerned, they turned me into a man. And man, they taught me so much. They taught me that responsibility is sacred. They taught me discipline, not discipline in the form of punishment, although there was plenty of that.
Self-discipline.
Right? Yeah, but discipline in the sense, if you had a job to do, you did it. Come hell or high water, you did it, and you know, you didn't have to like it, you didn't have to want to do it, but you had to do it. And so, and then they taught me that I could accomplish way more than I ever thought possible, and that I had a right to be proud.
I was going to say pride is something they definitely instill in me.
Well, you know, before then, I'd never been proud of anything. Yeah. Was after that.
You know, we were talking earlier, you know, speaking to companies, they all want to hear about the SEAL teams. And I say, no, we're starting with the Marine Corps. And I say the same thing. This, the Marine Corps, and I got to owe it to my parents. I grew up with just good folks. They laid the foundation, but the Marine Corps took that, and they put 20 pounds of concrete right on top of it. Because I wasn't a good high school student. And what I loved about reading your resume is this is the perfect example. And we're probably doing an infomercial for the Marine Corps here. Is a student that didn't do well in grammar school or high school. You go to college after Vietnam and you graduate with a magnum cum laude. I'm sure you didn't get smarter in those years, but you learned discipline, honor, courage, commitment, focus, the things that have driven you to this day.
Right. I mean, when I had a job to do in college, I took it very seriously, and I stayed with it till I did it. And, well, you know how it is.
How quickly, so after boot camp, do you go to the School of Infantry, or what school did you go to?
Well, School of Infantry, and then it was boot leave, and then it was 30 days boot leave, And, you know, I told you East Baltimore, tough town. One of the guys I went to boot camp with, he was stabbed to death on boot leave. He never even made it to Vietnam.
Good Lord.
Yeah. And so me and my buddy Charlie, we both went to Vietnam. I went to 26 Marines. He went to 1st Marines. We first went to what they called advanced infantry training at Camp Pendleton. And that was for a month or so. And then it was over to Vietnam, baby.
From the day you stepped into boot camp to the day you departed to Vietnam, what was that?
6 months.
What were you thinking as you go to Vietnam? You're rushed. You're accelerated through training very rapidly due to the demands of war and troops. Did you feel ready? I mean, do you remember what you were thinking?
Yeah, I felt ready. I mean, I felt ready, and you know, I wasn't ready, but I felt like I was. And I mean, you know, the biggest concern that we had, and this is being, you know, 18 years old, is we were worried that the war would be over before we got there.
Yeah.
You've heard that before.
Oh, yeah.
You know, everybody wants combat until they get it. And then you know, it's different.
I felt that same way. Came in the Marine Corps in 98, trained with the recon community, was a scout sniper. Then I make the switch to the SEALs. The, you know, 9/11 had happened. I didn't get to Iraq until 2005. And I'm like, I just want to feel, it's almost like a rite of passage to feel like a man. Yeah. And I'll tell you what, I didn't feel ready. I had 7 years of great training with both the Marine Corps and the SEALs. And I'm like, I'm not so sure I know what I'm doing.
Well,
but you figure it out.
Well, keep in mind, again, I was 18. I was too dumb to know I wasn't ready.
How long were you in Vietnam?
I was over there off and on for about 12 months. And the reason it was off and on is because when I first got there, I was with a rifle company, and in my company, the senior guy in my squad had been there for 6 weeks, and they had been ambushed just a few days earlier, and they had 4 KIAs and a wounded in action, and the rest of the guys were fairly new, and so it was, you know, they had some turnover. And so I lasted a month, and then I got hurt walking through a village. I hit a tripwire, detonated a Chi-Com grenade, and I caught shrapnel in my legs and in my elbow, and then I went to Japan, to the Naval Hospital at Cusco for that. And then after I come out of that, I went to Okinawa because I wasn't completely healed yet. Mm-hmm. And so anyhow, long story short, I had saved a guy's life the first night. He had a medevac chopper was going to land on him. One of the guys with us had a Chi-Com thrown at him. He picked it up, went to throw it back, and it went off in his hands. You know that story, right? And so I mean, the guys around him and everybody being new. I mean, this guy was hurt really bad. And so anyhow, the one dude was a squad leader. Was the squad leader of a sister squad that we were engaged with there. And this fucking Huey starts coming down, and I see it's going to land right on him. And I push, and it misses us both. Well, I saved his bacon. So he was wounded 2 weeks later. And we're told, you know, we're told he, you know, the Lord took him. And then when I was wounded, well, we both were out of there, but when I was down on Okinawa, I ran into him.
And right? You thought he was dead this whole time.
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah. And this had been, he told me this was his third heart. And in the Marine Corps, you get 3 hearts, you know, you don't go back into combat. So he said to me, you know, you saved my life, and I can, you know, what I'll do is, I am in intelligence now, and you know, or a guy that ran to this little printing press and was a courier back and forth to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. He says, I can get you that job, and he did. And so that's how I never went back to the rifle company. So it was a fluke of flukes. And so anyhow, a couple months go by. He volunteers to go back. He comes to me and he says, you know, I put in my request to go back and it's approved. I leave tomorrow. And, you know, I just wanted to say goodbye. And I said, why are you leaving, buddy? And he goes, you know, it's all the spit and polish. And I said, I hate it here. He says, Vietnam, I understand that. And so I said goodbye to him. It was the last time I would ever see or talk to him. And then about a month went by. I put mine in and goes through everything, gets to the company gunny, and the company gunny looks at it and goes, what the fuck you want to go back there for? I said, I want to be with the guys I serve with. Yeah. And he just ripped it up and he goes, you get yourself killed. He did that to me twice. So I never did go back. I tried.
You served your time.
I never did go back. But, I mean, Lord have mercy.
You know, I've heard different answers to this. I mean, did you enjoy being in country and around the guys?
I enjoyed being with the guys I served with. I mean, I thought so much of them. I mean, to me, you know, to me, this was the first time I was part of something I really wanted to be part of, and I felt good about being part of, and I'd have done anything for them. And
it's a tribe, and it becomes part of your DNA.
Yeah, for sure. As a matter of fact, Mike, I'm still in touch with the guys from my rifle squad that survived it.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. It's as I say, bonds that can never be broken, and quite frankly, what other people can't understand.
Mm-mm, never.
So eventually, you know, you're discharged from the Marine Corps. You go back to school. What'd you study in college?
Accounting. And the reason I studied accounting, I go to college, and I'm working as a laborer in a steel mill, and so I see this ad from the University of Baltimore where they say, all right, now, if you're a veteran, you can enroll in our school. You know, we'll help you with the GI Bill, right? Your high school grades doesn't matter as long as you got a high school diploma or a GED. You don't have to take any entrance exams. I thought, man, that's me, right? Nobody in my family had ever been to college before. So I go down there to register, and the guy asked me, he says, what do you want to major in?
The first one.
Well, yeah.
Accounting.
I didn't know what a major was. So he said to me, he said, well, you good with math? And I said, yeah, I think I am. And he said, you interested in business? I said, sure. And he goes, well, you probably should study accounting. And I said, sounds good to me. And then he said, you know, and if it doesn't click, you can always change it. Well, it was a fortuitous choice. I loved it.
No kidding.
Yeah, I loved it. I graduated with a degree in accounting, took the CPA exam, passed it the first time. Then, so I worked as an accountant. And then the way my life got on track is in 1975, I was sent to schedule the assets at its leasing company in Redwood City, California.
My hometown.
Get out of here.
I was born in Palo Alto, but lived in Redwood City for a time.
About that, brother? You're the first person I've ever met from Redwood City.
The heart of computers in Silicon Valley, yeah.
Yeah, so anyhow, when I finished up, I had 12 hours to kill. So I wound up on a Stanford campus, and I wound up at the bookstore, and I bought a book on how to program in a basic computer language. So I took the book and read it while I was waiting, and then I wrote my first program, and got it to work when I got back. And it just so happened that my company was owned by a company called Control Data, and we had this terminal in my office that ran the basic computer language, And so I you know, played with that and studied it and studied it and got good at it. And then I bought an Apple computer when they came out and studied Pascal. And the difference between me and a lot of people were when I wanted my computer to do something, I wrote the code. And I knew how the computer worked because I studied the architecture. So I got to be good at it. And so I wrote a program in 1984 that was called Money Counts that did family finances and accounting. And that was the foundation that started Parsons Technology. Yeah.
When you started Parsons Technology, did you create multiple forms of software in different lanes or mainly within the accounting space?
Well, at first it was accounting and then taxes. And then I ran into this guy who had a Bible concordance thing, which was the niftiest thing. You could look up anything in the Bible and you could have two different translations and compare them side by side. And I thought, wow, how cool is this? I mean, I could sell this thing like crazy. So I got together with him and we made a deal. And so that became the church software division.
No kidding.
Yeah. And then we started doing all sorts of other stuff on deals kind of like that. And by the time 1994 rolled around, I mean, I was releasing a new product every 6 weeks. Yeah.
Were you involved in building the software, or I mean, it's your company and running it, or did you have people creating the software? Or
Yeah. That was my biggest department. I mean, well, one of my biggest departments was, computer coding, the guys that would work on these software projects, and we were good. I mean, we're really good, and that's kind of how that company came together. And so I sold that company in 1995 to Intuit for $64 million. I had $40,000 in it. So that.
You did well.
It worked out.
I hear these stories. I'm not asking the sum. You've got a good bit of money. You're in the probably top 0.1%. Of the United States based off wealth at this point. Did you take a break?
Well, I had to, because what they did was they didn't want me competing with them. So they said I had a non-compete for 2 years. And that they defined that as working for anybody. So I did my non-compete. I played golf and, you know, whatever. I even tried to volunteer at the Veterans Administration. And this is a story. And they told me at the time, they said, we don't have any budget for volunteers. Yeah, I know.
You said, I don't want the money. I know.
They said, yeah, but we don't have any budget. And, they probably
can't take you free. Yeah.
Don't try to make sense of that.
It's the VA. Yeah. Would you ever take the Secretary of Veteran Affairs?
Excuse me.
Would you ever take that position?
I wouldn't take any government position.
I could. Yeah.
Yes. So anyhow, that's and then at the end of 2 years, I started what became GoDaddy. On the day after I was allowed to come.
When you started that, I'm young at this time. Were domains? I guess the World Wide Web was already out there.
Yeah, it was already out there. Very few people have websites. Just hadn't clicked yet.
But it clicked for you.
Well, what happened, not right away. What happened was, you know, we started doing all sorts of things trying to figure out how to make money on the internet, and nothing worked except building websites. And so we kind of thought, well, you know, building websites isn't going to work because for us, I mean, if we have to just build them from scratch for customers, because there's no way we can do enough to really
make money, get
an economy of scale. So what we did was we wrote a software product that would build the website for the customers, and it was called Website Complete, And that clicked eventually a little bit. And then we realized that every website needed a domain name. And so what we did was, it cost me $1 million and about a year in effort and to become authorized to sell domain names. And so we did, and we sold them cheap. And then, that was the idea, was that we would take domain names, and people would come to us to get the domain name, and we'd sell the software. Well, that was right as rain. The problem was, back then, there was so much noise from the dot-com boom that we couldn't get anybody to even realize we were there. And so what I would do, I would keep track of how the business was doing by how much cash I had. All right. So I started, I had about $36 million. I got divorced in the meantime, and that kind of put a dent in the cash. And then I would say, okay, I'm not going to worry about this till I get down to $30 million, $25 million, $20.
You kept lowering it.
18, 15, 12, 10, 8, 6. When I got down to $6 million, I decided, and this is in 2000. So I decided to go to Hawaii and think about how I'm going to shut it down while I still got a little bit of cash, because I didn't see any light at the end of the tunnel. So while I was in Hawaii, more and more as time went on, I didn't want to do it. And my epiphany happened when I run into this guy who's parking cars. And this guy's the happiest guy you ever want to meet, throwing the keys up in the air, going, yeah, baby, you know, this, that, the other thing. And, how you doing, Mr. Parsons? I said, this guy probably has nothing. He's parking cars. He's the happiest guy in the world. I got $6 million and I'm miserable. What's wrong with this picture? And so I thought, well, you know what? I'll go back and I'll just keep doing what I'm doing. I'll strap myself to the mast, so if the company goes down, I'll go down with it. But what happened was, when I didn't do anything different, and a few months after that, maybe not even, the dot-com crash happened. And when the dot-com crash happened, all the noise went away. And the companies I was competing with, you know, a lot of them went away. Every week, one or two companies we were doing business with would just vanish. And, I mean, we would get our checks that we sent them. They'd send them back to us, returned. And so what happened was, where I couldn't buy advertising from anybody because they wouldn't pay attention to us, before then, I had people, because I was one of the few guys paying my bills, that were standing in line to give us advertising. And then so the company took off. And in November of that year, we were profitable for the first time and never missed a month after that.
And you guys, I mean, your story of you guys grew so rapidly.
Yeah, we did. We did.
And I'm not saying this because you're here. I mean, when you think of domains, you think of GoDaddy. Will, can you answer another domain company? Can you rattle one off? It's almost like you guys had a monopoly on it.
Well, we worked hard, and we did a couple things. And the reason we did it is I always kept the company sharp and competitive. I would even cut rates if I didn't have to, if I was making too much money in an area. Because I didn't want other, open a window for competition.
Smart.
To be competing with us. And, the business itself, domain names and websites, is about as exciting as a cup of sawdust. But we took and made it fun.
You did.
And made the name very, memorable. And that's how GoDaddy was, came into its own. The company we competed with, that was number one when I went into that market, and I was warned not to do it, and because they said this is an established market, you know, the companies are entrenched. Well, about 3 years, we were even with them. And then a year and a half later, we doubled them. And then after that, you know, when I left, we had about a 75% market share. And their market share was like about 0.4%.
75% is unheard of. I mean, BlackBerry didn't even have 75%. They were the first smartphone to the market.
Well, that's what we got.
That's insane. I know you eventually grow it. And you know, the first exposure I had to GoDaddy was the Super Bowl commercial, which I laugh about now. I mean, it made those that have a sense of humor laugh. It pissed off the, I guess, the evangelical side, but it was risque for its time.
You know, I would have people that would write me emails. You know, mostly women and some men. They go, your ads are porn, and I said, if you think our ads are porn, you need to take a real hard look at where you get your porn.
What year was that?
Oh my God! It was up from 2000 to 2011.
You always had a release in the Super Bowl.
Oh, I had so much fun! It was just so much fun. You know, we did a deal with Danica Patrick in IndyCar.
Yes, I remember that.
And then she was fantastic. You know, you could talk to somebody and say, did you ever hear of a GoDaddy.com? They would say Danica Patrick. And then I'd go and ask somebody, have you ever heard of Danica Patrick? They'd say GoDaddy.com.
Yes.
So it was both things. Now, Danica's a dear friend of mine to this day, and she always says, I did more for her than she did for me. And I say she did more for us than we did for her.
No kidding.
So it's a perfect deal.
You know, in some ways, you almost created a genre of commercials, because then I remember it was a Carl's Jr. with Hilton, Paris Hilton.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was like, oh, hey, that's the GoDaddy sort of model.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what I liked about that, Mike, is they would show a commercial like that, Redentine Fire, mm-hmm. right? And then they'd show our commercial, or the first one right next to it. And I thought, am I living this right? You know? So it's like the first commercial we did, the one that you know, all the hell was over, mm-hmm. that commercial is taught in beginning advertising textbooks.
Because, the response overwhelming?
It was off the hook.
Website crashed?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a brilliant, brilliant move. Almost like the Apple 1984 commercial.
Oh, throwing the hammer,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was a guy behind that was a guy who was somewhat of a mentor to me, a guy named Bill Campbell, came from a coal mining town in Philadelphia, and then was a college football coach. He was actually, he became the CEO of Intuit.
I knew Bill Campbell.
You did?
I did, yeah.
An amazing man.
Yeah. Wonderful guy.
Coach.
Great, personable. Everybody called him Coach.
Yes. Again, growing up in that area, I'd gotten to meet him young. And then when he had heard I'd become a Navy SEAL through a mutual friend, wrapped his arms around me and my guys and did some phenomenal things for us just to help us out.
Oh, good guy. Good dude.
Small world. So eventually you exit the company, which is one of the largest exits anyone can ever anticipate. And I know you've stood up YAM. And what is YAM? It's got to stand for something.
It's an acronym for You're a Mess.
Where does that come from?
Well, it's a saying that we used in Baltimore, which was never an insult. It was like a term of endearment. You know, you see your buddy, you know, they do something silly, you go, oh, you're a mess. You're a fucking mess, but you're a mess.
Yeah. And now you've transitioned into passion projects. Key amongst them is, and Will, if you could throw PXG golf. I know you're an avid golfer.
I am.
And first off, I love the Black Ops edition. And I noticed you named the clubs like 0311. Is that the MOS?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. For the audience, 0311 is a It's an MOS, a military occupational specialty. It stands for this particular one, rifleman, which you were a rifleman. I was an 0311 at one point. It's a term of endearment.
You know, my buddy Jake Wood, who is heads up Team Rubicon, or used to, and as the chairman, he always says, you know, he was sniper 0317. He says, yeah, Bobby, you were an 03 dum-dum. And I tell him, I say, Jake, I love it. Don't call me nothing else.
I had to go look up the 0317 because back when I was in, it was an 8541. Snipers were an 8541, but it was a secondary MOS. Now it's a primary. But these, you've definitely, I mean, you just didn't start another golf line. You look at these in the, one, the aesthetics of it are just beautiful.
Yeah, well, we work hard on it. We work hard. That's one tough business, and
it's so saturated.
Yeah, I mean, we're doing well in it, you know, I can tell you right now that you compare those to any other clubs made, we make the best stuff.
So not only performance but aesthetic as well.
Yeah.
I mean, they look black. I mean, they I've been reading black. They look badass, and I'm not even a golfer.
Well, they are. I mean, you know, this is the thing that we did with the Black Ops driver is most drivers are in two categories. Either they go far or they're easy to hit. This is one that goes far and is very easy to hit.
Did you guys spend a fortune on R&D? This?
We do. We spend what it takes, and I can tell you right now, we have it's called a Black Ops Challenge, where somebody can bring their driver into our store, and they can hit it into, you know, using a TrackMan, you know, thing that'll tell you how far you hit it. You know, they can hit their driver, and then they can hit our driver, and if they beat our driver, we'll give them $100. Well, we've won. We're winning 98% of them.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
How's penetrating the market? Because I mean, you're going against what's called just companies that are historic now. Yeah.
Behemoth. Yeah, Titleist and TaylorMade and Callaway. I mean, they're just huge.
But they're old. They feel like a old country club.
Yeah. They are. You know, they, you know, I will say they do a good job. I mean, that's the competition. And the deal that makes it even tougher is the golf industry is a small industry.
Incestuous.
And it really is not growing much.
It, as a sport, is golf growing though?
Right.
It's been interesting what's been going on. I have been paying attention. I work with Folds of Honor, which is a great organization. Sure. I know you've given a lot of philanthropic money, and I know I want to make sure it's your wife's name and your name, the Bob and Renee Parsons Foundation.
Correct.
But they're huge on golf. They hold great golf tournaments, but the LIV and the PGA sort of debacle has been interesting. It seems like, and is it LIV? Is it LIV?
LIV, yeah.
They've seemed to have done a very good job penetrating into the professional golf space.
Well, I mean, if you have the money that the Saudis do,
who
are behind LIV, I mean, they're paying these guys like you know, $500 million to switch over, and you're looking, you know, like they've been playing for years, and they've only won $50 million. So I mean, of course they're going to switch, right? But you know, that still isn't settled yet. But you know, we'll see. And you know, whatever it does, you know, that's what it does. You know, it's like you would when you're in combat. Whatever happens, baby, you deal with it.
Yeah, ain't that the truth? But that's the same as life.
Yeah,
yeah. 100%. It's just some people are not built that way to pick themselves up and keep moving on.
For sure.
You also own a couple Harley Davidsons.
I own one Harley Davidson store, but it happens to be the largest motorcycle store in the world.
Is that in Scottsdale? Where is that?
That's in Scottsdale, Arizona. And the store is 150,000 square feet. I mean, we have a lingerie boutique. We have a movie theater.
No kidding.
We have a tattoo and piercing studio. We have an old fashioned barber who is just wonderful to get a, you know, nice haircut and a hot shave from. And we have a wedding chapel there.
When have you, do people ever say, Bob, when you go big, you go big?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, it's paid off for you.
Well, I mean, you know, there's only one way to do it. That's right.
Do it big. Yeah, do it right and do it big. Do it loud is what I say. That's one, again, as I said, you give back, especially to impoverished communities. It seems to be a focus of your foundation, underprivileged communities. Is that due to your upbringing, is trying to lift other people up?
Well, yeah, I think so. I think so. You know, I think back about when you know I was growing up, man. We didn't have, I mean, we didn't have much, and so you know, I tend to when somebody's in a pinch, you know, I tend to hear them. So you know, we tend to we reach out to the organizations we specialize in helping outside of the military. Okay, is organizations that have difficulty raising funds because their cause is not glamorous, but that they're doing a good job. When you there's an organization like that, you'll find us if it's in the Phoenix, Scottsdale area.
Buddy of mine, Seal, once said it. He said, I've done a lot of things, and he saw a good portion of combat in our war, which is very different from Vietnam. When I hear stories from Vietnam, and the Vietnam vet looks at me and says, do you have any stories? I say, no. he said raising money is the hardest thing he's ever done. And I know in the nonprofit world that it is, it's a knife fight. It's not fun. Yeah. That's great to know that there's people like you that are willing to just give, give, give. I want to hit two more subjects. I know you're on a timeline. And for the audience, it's South by Southwest here in Austin. You've been a big advocate, and this one's dear to my heart, with regards to PTSD and therapeutic, you know, advocacy, treatment advocacy. I can only imagine the trauma from Vietnam. Is that something that has been a lifelong struggle, as well as I know your upbringing,
you know,
there's trauma there?
You know, it was. When I came back from the war, Mike, I was a different guy than the guy that left. I had this is all going to sound familiar to you, but I had a flash temper, right? Didn't really want to be around groups. You know, I wanted to be just kind of tucked away. I mean, you know, I fought depression. People said I was really intense, you know, and I was. And, you know, I just felt so different from everybody else.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the flip side to all this. And so, you know, I kind of swallowed it and swallowed it and swallowed it. And then when the troops came home from Desert Storm, That's when it was like a sucker punch to me in the gut. I mean,
for how well they were received.
Yeah, and I wasn't jealous of them. I was happy for them, but it was just such a fuck over for us. You know, I mean, you know, we not only were not welcomed home or had any kind of a welcome for that matter, but I mean, there were people calling us all kind of fucking
baby
names
killers and
yeah, Nazis, drug addicts. I mean, on and on and on, and it just was wrong. It was so wrong. I mean, you know, if they had seen the shit that we had to deal with, and that we did a lot of good over there. Maybe they'd you know, they'd have thought differently, but you know, it hurt me. And that I took and buried myself away, and just wrote my a little bit of what happened on the first night and the last night in the bush. And So then after that, you know, I seen a psychologist. It was an old Navy ensign. He helped me a little bit.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a number of years later, I found the guys I served with on the internet, and they were having a get-together down in Gulfport, Mississippi. I went down and hung out with them, and that helped me so much. So much. I mean, I felt like I took a shower after I left them. And then I, you know, I did some other things, some neurofeedback, and that's an SGB block. Mm-hmm. But the thing that really helped me was I read this book in 2018 by Michael Pollan. It's called How to Change Your Mind. You know the book?
Yes.
Yeah, and it's a treatise on plant medicine and psychedelics and what they've been used for over the years and what they're capable of doing and what they once did in this country before, you know, the country got stupid and shut it all down, you know? And so I told my wife, I said, Renee, and now the other thing that PTSD did, it cost me my first two marriages, without a doubt.
Yeah.
And I mean, and both those women hung on as long as they could, and then they just couldn't take it anymore, and then I got my walking papers. Well, and then I met Renee a number of years later, and we eventually got married. And, you know, she helped me. And when I told her about this book and I'd like to try, because I'd never taken any psychedelics. I mean, I didn't have any idea what they would do. You know, I believed all the shit. You'd take LSD, you want to jump off the roof and fly. Well, that's not it at all. Well, so anyhow, she linked me up with a couple people that are guides underground, help mm-hmm. veterans mm-hmm. and help others. So we met in Hawaii, and after, you know, we're all kind of got to know each other. The first day, they give me ayahuasca.
Yes.
And man, that's some nasty tasting shit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, but anyhow, you know, I hallucinated a little bit, seen little lights flashing here and there, but, you know, talked a lot, you know, some tears. The next day, the guy says to me, you know, I got made a pot of tea from magic mushrooms. It holds 3 cups, but I made it really strong, so you only need 1 cup. Well, I drank all 3 cups, and I ate the tea bags. That's no bullshit. So I was fucking sailing, baby. So a lot of tears, a lot of memories, the next day I took off, and it was like the leaves and the trees knew I was there on the golf course. I mean, you know, I would play 9 holes with Renee, and it was like the green, the grass was saying to me, hit it here, Bobby. And I did, and it go right in the cup, you know. And the best I ever putted in my life.
No kidding.
Yeah, yeah. And so good. And then the last day was LSD.
Yes.
But the deal was, After it was over, I was a different guy. I mean, I was like I should have been. I Renee noticed it first. The people that I work with noticed it immediately. They said, "What happened to Bob?"
Yeah.
He go, "He's so nice. He's so relaxed. He, you know, he doesn't get upset. He's this, that, and the other thing." And I was. And my son told his wife, he says, "I think Dad just found out he's going to die soon." And she goes, "Why?" And he goes, "Well, he just keeps calling. And he's so nice." So I took him through the plant medicine thing that I did. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, since then, I've become a total advocate. I've got those people that I worked with to work with my squad leader and my machine gunner. And I went through it again with them. And those two were the same way. They were just like, you know, beside themselves as they were going through it. When they got home, both their wives called me and go, thank you so much. It's good. Thank you for giving me my husband back. And it works.
This is where government needs to get out of the way, and it needs to be approved in the United States. So I went and did Ibogaine and DMT, 5-MeO DMT, and it was life-changing. And actually, the first week of January, we went to Rhythmia Resort in Costa Rica and did ayahuasca. I didn't have as great an experience on ayahuasca. Ibogaine is a lot more powerful, but there are some great organizations doing a lot of work with psychedelics, and veterans are, they're different coming back.
Well, you know, brother, my hat's off to you. I don't know about Ibogaine, but I know it's the major leagues.
It was rough. It was a rough night. But 5-MeO DMT was the most spiritual thing I've ever done in my life.
Wow.
It was, I almost wanted my parents to do it because it helped me let go of the guilt, the survivor's guilt, which I know you had as well, to a high degree. And it takes a lot of courage to talk about that publicly, because I always fear about, you know, because I came from a Catholic family. It took me a while to tell my parents that I went and did it, and they said, good on you. If it worked, good on you. But I just always, we always, having grown up in the Bay Area, equated psychedelics with hippies.
Yeah.
And I think it's just putting that stigma down.
Well, you know, here's what I know. Take a mushroom. See, I testified for the Arizona State Senate 2 weeks ago and helped them get it through committee.
Good.
And the Senate passed it. And Monday I'm testifying through the Arizona House and, you know, to relaying my experience to them, and hopefully that'll help. But we've been making donations, funding field trials to get the FDA to do it, and other general research. You know, we're doing funding at Berkeley for general research, general psychedelic research. And a woman there, Dr. Gall Dolan, is working with Octopus. And what she's working on critical periods. And what a critical period is like, you know, there's when a person's a certain age, and I'm talking about a child's age, mm-hmm. they can learn a language in a finger snap, right? Well, that critical period is only open for like a year.
The neural plasticity.
And then it goes away.
Yes.
Well, and for people that have, you know, inflammatory diseases or autoimmune diseases, it all boils down to, you know, your body naming something that is common as an enemy. And it does that if you're not exposed to it during the critical period when that such a thing is determined. Well, Dr. Dolan believes that psychedelics can reopen those critical periods and then close them again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if she's successful in that, this is way in the future, mm-hmm. what a marvelous thing. What a breakthrough. It's huge.
I was taking psilocybin microdosing.
Yes.
And great. I felt great on that. I stopped contacting the guy that supplies me and a lot of the vets I know, but I intend to get back on that. Hell, I gave one of my best speeches on psilocybin. I'll be honest. I just crushed it. Smiles. But Bob, first, thank you for coming on. The book, Fire in the Hole, comes out on May 7th. I know this is going to be a bestseller. It's got to be. And you are very candid and vulnerable with some of the trauma in your life. And I know that's hard to put into a book and out into the world. It takes a lot of courage. I commend you for that. Thank you for what you've done. Thank you for continuing to give back to veterans. You don't have to, but you do. And for those that don't know, if you're in the golf community, you're an avid golfer. My dad dedicated the better half of it, or his life still going. Check out PXG Extreme Golf Clubs. They are beautiful. And I believe what you say, they're both high performing and great to hit. I'm going to leave you and I'm going to let you finish this off and then we'll cut. But, you know, I do ask certain guests, not many, you've done a lot from war to starting billion-dollar businesses to following your passion to confronting your demons. What do you consider to be, you know, maybe the 2 to 5 sort of key principles you have followed in life that have led to the majority of your success and happiness?
Well, the first thing is I look forward. I never look backwards. I mean, I always look forward. I don't give a fuck what happened yesterday, but what I'm very concerned about is what might happen tomorrow. And taking care of that, that's the first thing. The second thing is, and this is more of a gift, but you can train yourself to do it. I never worry. Not about a thing. And that is just not having that shackle. It's great. And what I found is most of the stuff that the people around me worry about is down the road, it always turns out to be nothing. I mean, you just worry about nothing. Mm-hmm. So you know, not to worry. And one other thing is, like, you know, there's in business, there's two groups of people you need to be concerned with. One is your employees, and the other is your customers. The most important group are your employees. And what your job should be is, you know, to have your employees where they're excited and they're enthusiastic about what they're doing. And if you're able to accomplish that, then what happens is they do the same thing to your customers who then, and what do we know about enthusiasm? It's contagious, baby.
Yeah.
And there you go. And then the other thing is, you know, how do you get through something tough? One day at a time, baby. You know, that's the same way you eat an elephant, one bite at a time. Yeah, and that's the way you do it. You know, when I first got to Vietnam, I seen that, you know, the most of the guys were just really green. And even the guy calling the shots, who turned out to be marvelous, but the Marine Corps has a way of doing that. I remember thinking, man, there's no way I am going to survive this. And I learned two lessons that day. Okay. The first lesson is, if you have something really tough in front of you, quantify what the worst thing that can happen is. What's got you spooked, right? And a lot of times, once you quantify it, it's much easier to deal with than some big, dark boogeyman you don't even know what it is, but you're just scared of the room because the lights are out, you know? And so what I did that first day was I told myself, this is where I'm going to die. And once I did that and really accepted it, I mean, it was like a fucking huge weight lifted off my shoulders. And so I accepted that. And then the other thing was I made myself two promises then. My first promise was that I would do everything I could to do my job as a United States Marine. And so my, you know, parents would be proud and so forth. And, you know, that's what I would do. And the second thing I promised myself is that my only goal would be to be alive for mail call the next day. That would be it. And you know how important mail call was, yeah. Right? And then, you know, when you're with a bunch of guys, if you don't get a letter, you read theirs. Yeah. So anyhow, that was it. You know, day to time, and quantify what the worst possible thing can be. And you do those things,
you're gonna live a good life. You got a
much better chance of getting through it.
Well, my only response to that is hoorah.
Hoorah.
Hoorah. Thank you. All right, guys. That's been an episode of The Everyday Warrior. I'm your host, Mike Cirelli. We will see you again next time.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.